Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/Wondery and use code Wondery for 20% off your first purchase.
There's a lot to say when buying a new home or car, but only one thing to say that can help you protect them. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. And just like that, a State Farm agent will be there to help you choose the coverage you need, no matter where you are in life. When you need coverage options, your State Farm agent is there to help, on the phone or in person. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
Welcome to the Nerdist Podcast number 263. This is a super fun episode, which took a little bit longer to get up because it's a kind of a musical episode. Well, not kind of, it is a musical episode. And so we just spent a little more time kind of editing it together and making sure it was mixed and all that stuff. My pal Sarah Watkins, whom I've adored for years and years and years, huge Nickel Creek fan. We had her on the Craig Ferguson episode in the first year of the podcast, and she did such an amazing job. Craig ended up having her on the his show, and our fans of the podcast really, really seem to enjoy Sarah Watkins. And for those who hadn't heard of her before, like, who is this amazing, talented songstress? And so this year, Sarah released a new album called Sun, Midnight Sun, which is amazing. You definitely feel the sort of growth from the last album to this one, I think. And so I said, hey, let's do sort of like a storyteller's episode where we all go into a studio. You know, we'll talk, you play a song, we'll talk some more, you play a song, just to try it and see, you know, like, see how it goes. And it was amazing. We had, I had Paul F. Tompkins sit in with us, because he knows the Watkins really well and wanted to have him on. And then we had a small grouping of people there to watch, like Acker and Blacker were there, and Chloe was there, and a few other people. And then Kate Micucci, who then came and sat and talked with us a little bit about, you know, music and comedy, and just sort of joined the conversation. It was super, super, super fun. And it ended with a kind of a surprise performance that Sarah Watkins had put together with her brother Sean. So it was a really, really fun way to end the podcast. So here we go. The Nerdist Podcast is episode number 263 with Sarah Watkins. I'd like to thank Amazon.com for sponsoring this episode of the podcast. If you go to this podcast page, click the Amazon banner, and shop as you normally would, you will support the Nerdist Podcast. Oh, also, by the way, I think it's appropriate to say that I will be performing in Nashville at Zany's the beginning of December. My Comedy Central special airs November 10th, so I have to put together new material. So I'm gonna go back out on the road for a bit and assemble a new hour, and so I would love for you to be a part of that. So early in December I'll be at Zany's in Nashville, and there's some other dates coming up, so that's that. And here it is, the Nerdist Podcast, episode number 263, with the wonderful Sarah Watkins.
Now entering Nerdist.com.
Recording at Bedrock Studios in Los Angeles. This is a special Sarah Watkins podcast.
Why do all of our shows start with you saying we are recording?
Well, so because I want to let everyone know what's happening, Matt.
Okay.
Do you know why? It's for future generations.
I was just curious. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I've been at 200 of these now.
Eric, my voice is heavily echoed. Is that just in my headphones, or is that? Oh, great.
Oh, no.
Is that going to pick up in the actual recording of the show? Oh, nice. Okay.
He's lying.
Great. Great. So we're here with a room full of people who can all make a bit of noise if you want to prove that there's...
It's the saddest.
1, 2, 3.
Oh, sir.
Boo.
Sir.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. Great. So Sarah's here, and...
Chris now has to count everyone in the room before he can speak.
Oh, shoot. I'm a little OCD that way. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. 9, 10. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 7, 8. 9, 10.
Okay.
I have to do that 10 times.
Gotta be 10 every time.
And then square that by 2.
You forgot to count the band.
Oh, fucking ruined everything, Matt. Now
I'm
going to start over.
I didn't notice.
great. So, Sarah Watkins, you want to kick it off with a song and then we'll chat.
Sure.
Ladies and gentlemen, Sarah Watkins.
Valley sunshine, burn out of town, make your head all funny, so you stick around. Dusty roads make dirty feet. I remember you, I remember me, I remember the night, I remember the sound, I remember the light. The night flowers bloom, the air is so sweet. I remember you, I remember me. Wish I knew you now, like I knew you then. For hours I'd just sit at your feet and listen. Feel free. I remember you. I remember me. I remember the night. I remember the sound. I remember the light. When the moon came around, the night flowers bloom. The air is so sweet. I remember you. I remember me. Piano, and I swear I could hear you sing. And the joy we shared as we tarried there, I remember you, I remember me. I remember the night, I remember the sound, I remember the light. When the moon came around, the night flowers bloomed. The air is so sweet. I remember you. I remember me. I remember you. I remember me. I remember you.
I woo at you, Sarah Watkins.
This is the most awkward position to watch someone perform from.
It almost
sitting at a table microphone.
Yeah, let me just try to paint the picture here. We're sitting at a table like we're judging a fucking reality show.
Yep.
And I apologize for that. But it was the easiest way to sort of like, oh, we could get you to play. And then I invited a bunch of people. Paul F. Tompkins is here.
Oh, hi.
Paul M. Tompkins. Oh, not really.
Oh, thanks, some of you.
God. These L.A. crowds.
That was horrible.
Paul, let me... Here, I'll do warm-up for you. Come on, guys. You can do better than that. Ladies and gentlemen, Paul F. Tompkins is here.
Yay.
Boo. Who's booing? You are.
Yeah, I know.
You're self-destructive.
There's the proof right there.
But yeah, I wanted you to be on the show because you've done a lot of the Watkins Family Hour shows at Largo.
It's true. We have performed together many, many times.
And when was this going back to the old Largo as well?
This goes back to the old Largo.
Oh, yes.
I've been on their show. They've been on my show.
Now you're both on my show.
Yeah.
It's pretty weird the way
it works.
Will the
circle be unbroken?
I don't know. Matt, have you been on either of their shows?
No.
Oh, this is awkward.
Take a powder.
Yeah, I will.
Take a powder. But, sir, we had you on.
Take a powder?
Yeah, like it's like an old 30s thing. Like, yeah, take a powder. Like,
30s. Specifically the 30s was when.
It's, yeah, it's the thing you say
like
in
a powder
your 30s.
Break?
I'm sorry. No, I meant 1730s. Take thy powder.
Yeah, because everybody had those wigs.
No one said thy in the 1730s?
Sure, some of them did.
Nope, they didn't.
Yeah, they did.
So there were some holdouts.
Yeah, they were really.
Just hanging on to that.
Yep. Perfectly good word. Thy may do as I please.
I don't know why I must throw it away. You did one of our first live shows at Largo when we had the Craig Ferguson episode of the Nerdist podcast.
Was that one of your first ones?
That was our second live show. And we had you as a musical guest, and you blew everyone away. And people who listened were like, holy fuck, Sarah Watkins. And so now you got a new album. And so I want you to come on and hang out.
I really appreciate that. No, I still, people will tweet me and they'll tweet you as well in the same tweet and say, wow, I heard you on The Nerdist and it's so great. And it's, I a lot of people.
Who would have thought a podcast?
I know, right? It was really nice.
You're welcome.
That is not.
I hadn't gotten around to finishing that, but cool.
So you sent me the album maybe a month ago. And and it was amazing. And we had talked about, you know, you said, oh, I kind of want to write this bio, but I want my bio to be weird and funny. And, you know, do you want to take a crack at writing this bio? And here's the album. And the album was so different from the, is that, they'll clip that out.
No, it's
fine. The studio's haunted.
Have you ever seen that show, Musical Ghost Hunters?
Musical Ghost Hunters, I don't know why more people aren't watching it.
Yeah.
Because my problem with regular Ghost Hunters is I wish there was music.
I mean, they would hunt the ghosts with, they would trap the ghosts with music.
Yeah.
Because
ghosts can't resist it.
They can't. And that's how they, and the instruments would also be like electro containment systems.
That's right. Ghosts love to dance.
That's all they want.
They waltz.
Yeah. That's right. A lot of waltz. A lot
of waltzing. If you've been to the Haunted Mansion at Disneyland, you know that they love to waltz.
Yeah. It's like, would thy dance with me?
You've been using that for centuries. Just die already. Follow the light.
There's room for one more. Oh, sorry.
But your new album, Sun, Midnight Sun, is so different than the Sarah Watkins, the first album.
Yeah,
so
it is.
So what, and when we had lunch to sort of talk about your album, you talked about, you know, like, yeah, I turned 30 and then I was like, I just felt more comfortable with my, and so you kind of like, took this whole different direction.
Yeah, the last couple of years I feel like more like a normal person where I'm still guessing at a lot of things, but I don't know, I just feel a lot more comfortable singing and touring and just doing everything and just living life, I guess. And it's really nice. It's really comfortable, I feel like.
I don't know.
I mean, sometimes. I still have anxiety attacks, but.
Oh, aren't those the best?
Awesome.
You know, like when someone's just standing on your chest, there's just a ghost standing on your chest waltzing.
Yeah.
There's a ghost in this.
Yeah.
That's what I was trying to bring it back to ghosts. But you feel a lot more comfortable now? Like,
yeah,
like,
and I wanted to do something different, and so I wrote...
What did you rape?
I rigged an election.
Oh, my God, is that how now?
I rigged my friend Blake Mills.
It must feel so good to say it out loud.
You know, it's kind of like a ghost has lifted off my chest or something.
A rape ghost is gone.
Yeah.
And you feel a lot better now.
So that happened in December.
Is he okay?
Maybe you read it about in the papers.
He's probably fine. I don't know. It's we don't really talk anymore.
Where that ghost blows Dan Aykroyd.
Our friendship kind of changed after that.
I would imagine.
I forgot about that. Exactly.
Well, but I want to say your husband Todd has been amazing about it.
He's so understanding,
forgiving, and like, I get it.
He's a modern guy.
He really is.
He's had it in the year before, right? Let's say things we remember. That's always fair.
So I roped in my friend Blake Mills to produce it, and rope doesn't really help the whole
at all. It's
either.
Fine. It's fine.
But anyway, we made it, and it was really fun. We did it here in LA, in Tony Berg's garage, really nice studio, and it was great. Sean and Blake and I, my brother Sean, who's playing guitar, here.
Hey, Sean Watkins.
Hey.
We did all the recording together, and it was super fun.
So I know a lot of people who already are familiar with your work probably know this, but just sort of give us a history of, like, you've pretty much been playing music your entire life.
Yeah, I grew up playing when I was six. I started playing taking fiddle lessons when I was four. Actually, my parents, Sean was taking piano lessons, and his teacher said you should go to this pizza parlor. My son plays in a bluegrass band, so I was two, and we kind of grew up with this bluegrass fan group in San Diego. It's very small, but it felt gigantic. And so we got to know the band. And when I was four, I requested a song, Long Black Veil. Do you know it?
No.
It's a murder ballad.
It's very good. Yeah, Dave Matthews covered it.
Oh. That's how he knows it.
Johnny Cash.
Yeah.
So anyway, they got me on stage when I was young, and Sean was playing mandolin and guitar, and our friend Chris Thiele, and then we eventually started a band when Chris and I were 8 and Sean was 12 on this just sort of fluke, played a bluegrass festival thing and a band contest, and then we just stayed together for 18 and a half years.
Oh, wow.
And then that brought us to 2007, and we basically had grown up together playing music. And then I'd meant to put out a solo record for a long time, but just hadn't really had the focus. I didn't know what I wanted to play really, or what I wanted to do. And and around like the time we decided to put the band on the shelf, I thought, well, I should probably figure this out. And and then I put out the self-titled record, which was pretty comfortable. The material was really comfortable and really fun to play. But this record has been even more fun because there's a little bit, I felt like I got a little kick in the pants a little bit to do something different. And so that's why collaborating with especially Blake, who I didn't know very well at the time, was really exciting, because we were just kind of figured out what the other was bringing to the table while we were recording. And it was really fun.
Is it more important, do you think, to just want to play music and record music? Or do you feel like you have to have something to say when you're making an album?
It makes it more fun because it lasts longer. Like, you, for me, at least when I'm playing songs that I've written, even if I'm not in that same place for the years after while I'm performing it, at least it came from something specific at a time, and I can remember that and identify with it and just acknowledge that it was a part of me. And even with covers, if you identify with them strongly, they will last longer, and it makes it more fun to play them night after night rather than just, here's another song that somebody wrote that I don't really care about that I'm going to play again.
Where did Nickel Creek come in?
Well, Nickel Creek was the
18 and a half years. And a half band. Okay.
Yeah, I didn't say that. Yeah, sorry.
Oh,
but
okay.
Yeah, so that was Nickel Creek, and we did a lot of touring and we just grew up together.
Do you even?
Until I was 27.
Oh, you have to be careful about touching that. It'll pick up on that. Oh, that's okay. The table will be sensitive. Michael, pick it up.
I have one of those records from when you guys were kids. It's like Little Cowpoke or something
like
that.
Oh, goodness. Why do you have that one?
Awesome.
I was thinking about any of the other numbers.
It was after I met you guys and got into your music, and then I was just looking for stuff online, and I saw this.
The cover looked appealing?
I could not, because I knew.
The Lariat
font? This has to be from
font?
When they were kids. There's like a cartoon cow, yeah. And then...
Oh, I can get behind that.
It's adorable, because they're clearly children, but the playing is still like unbelievable, you know. And I there was a trio that I saw on Letterman like last year, the year before, of three young kids.
I saw that too. Yeah,
yeah. And I thought of you guys. And but these guys, those kids were even older than you guys were, I think.
I don't know. I mean, yeah, they're pretty impressive and pretty. I don't know how old they are, but poor Sean. Was 16 when we made that Little Cowpoke record. And we drove...
Hey, Little Cowpoke!
We were... I was 12, and it was kind of a lesson in a commitment. Well, we thought it was going to be... It's
that
lesson
of commitment we all get when we're
12. I'm trying to make this sound better with every fragment sentence, and it's just not starting. Basically, we went through a cowboy music phase. We went to... The Western Music Association in Old Tucson,
The WMA and OT?
Yeah. Yeah. The William Morris Agency has an office in Tucson?
Yeah, that's right.
That's weird.
In the OT.
They made a bunch of Westerns there and everything, and there's, you know, yodeling contests and things. And so anyway, we did that for a little bit. And so to cap it off, we decided to make this children's Western music record CD. And then like halfway through the year-long process of weekends driving up to Los Angeles, we decided this is not at all what we wanted to do at all. But it was our parents being like, no, you said you were going to do it. You're going to do it. So we had to do it. But poor Sean was 16 and like had to leave.
I don't want to be a little cow. I just want to be a cowpoke.
He's like living this double life.
Like Hannah Montana?
Yeah, exactly. Except for like not. The secret life was unbelievably uncool.
Hey, you look a lot like little cowpoke, but nope. I guess that's not you.
Not me.
They're bolo ties.
Is it... what does it feel like to sort of make the transition from, you know, when you're playing as a member of a group and then it's like, oh, it's just me now?
Yeah, it was, you know what? The Watkins Family Hour, which you mentioned, is this show that Sean and I have done at Largo for 9.5 years now.
A podcast coming to the Nerdist Network.
Yeah, we've recently started podcasting.
Is there
it.
Nothing you won't put
scoop.
On the network?
Shut the fuck up, man.
You're going to have all the podcasts pretty soon.
Yeah, I'm going to have all the I'm going to be iTunes. What is wrong with that? I aim high, Matt.
It's fine.
I aim high.
Good, good. Thanks for putting out Feed, by the way.
Oh, good. You're welcome. That's Matt's podcast.
Yes, podcast I do.
Way to plug that in.
Yeah.
So,
no, I don't have yours.
Oh, no. So, Family Hour was really helpful in that transition from the band because Sean and I would do it. We would do this monthly show whenever we were off the road. And it was sort of this place just to try out songs that we wanted to play for fun. And it was low pressure gig from a very focused Nickel Creek. We would just kind of play songs that we liked. And it was really, really fun. And over the years, I became a lot more comfortable in just different settings and singing different songs. And that was really helpful, really, really helpful in figuring out what I would want to do on a solo record and how I want to behave on stage when it's a different setting. And when, because everything that I did was standing on stage right with Sean and Chris next to me. And it was always just like this, the momentum of the band was, it was hard to... I didn't recognize it at the time necessarily, but when it was gone, I was like, oh, wow, where's all that momentum that my friends aren't here? But Sean comes out with me a lot on the road, which is more helpful than I could say. And Tyler Chester, who's playing basses, has been out, and it's pretty. I'm not really alone. I have a good team of people.
Oh, that's
I'm not really alone.
No. No anxiety. You're fine. You're fine. Look, you're surrounded by friends.
And of course, ghosts.
always ghosts. They're waltzing around us. Well, ghosts waltz around us is my new book.
Joining us today, author of Ghosts Waltzing Around Us, Christopher Hardwick.
It is true.
I become.
Why do you have that accent?
Because I have to talk like this to summon the ghosts.
Well, when you were writing your book, did you write it in the accent?
Yes. Ghosts love the television show Perfect Strangers.
Your accent's changing right now as you've thought of that reference.
But when I listened to this, to the second album, Sun, Midnight, Sun, it just, I don't know, you kind of grab the listener and just fucking shake them. Like, it really grabs you in a really big
Thanks.
Way. And it's a pretty bold sounding album, like right off the bat.
Sweet. That's great.
Is there, would you play another song?
Yes. Yes, we will.
Okay.
Let's figure out what that will be.
Okay.
And I will head over to the station.
While you're doing that, I will talk about the ghosts that waltz among us. It's a 3-3 time.
No, it's the three, first 3-3 time novel.
3-3 time in the time signature.
And it's the first book to be written in a phonetic accent. Is that correct?
It's in a phonetic accent. The letters are invisible to the living.
People are very mad about this book.
There's been, you know, it's a bold choice when your goal is to stall while people are setting up instruments.
Why is the book $75? That seems steep.
Is the audiobook
maybe to you, but to the undead, what are they going to do with money?
Good point. Interview concluded.
Their currency is ectoplasm.
Thank you for joining us, Christopher Hardwick, author of
this record. There are three cover songs.
Yes, it is. Everything is.
It's a podcast.
What are you going to play?
Probably.
Oh, he's friends with your buddy Dave Matthews.
Oh my God!
Right? Aren't they pals?
I don't know. Are they? I don't know everything
this
about
is him.
Like they should. I know a lot of things about him, but not.
I was misinformed.
His dad died when he was 10. He moved to Virginia. Forget it. That's another podcast.
What's what song are you gonna play? What's it called?
This is called
Winnipeg. All right.
This is
Tuning with a Capo.
This is one that kind of underwent quite a change. Sean showed me this song when he was playing on a demo of Dan Wilson's, and he brought it home and or back to my place, and we kind of stole it. But Dan came by the studio and said it was okay afterwards, which was nice.
Well, I guess it's fine now.
Yeah. Yeah. You love me when it pleases you. When it's easy to do, you hold me when you don't want anybody else to. You love me when it pleases you. Stars come out, I walk the roadside, see them turning around. If you watch them long enough, you might see one fall.
stuck in one for too long, and you can't see it at all.
You never want to clap at the wrong time, where you clap and then they're not done.
Oh,
it's like, oh,
that has happened to me before.
Oh,
that
shit!
Happened at the at the Old Largo one time, Ricky Lee Jones was she did like an impromptu set at one of John Bryan's shows. She's playing the song on the piano, and it's like a very quiet song. And then the end of the song, she hits a note on the piano, and like it rings out, and like I thought it was over. But it wasn't over yet. And so I started clapping, and people...
Just to get that first clap in.
Not to get the first...
It's always
performers
that
do. Come on.
You're still that guy. Come on.
Look, it's true. I love to win. I like to... Here's the thing. If you get in first with your claps, everyone in the audience knows who is the alpha male.
You're an alpha clapper.
I'm an alpha clapper.
That's what they tell you if you take any of those airport Marriott seminars on how to win things.
That's right.
They're like,
yeah, we've all seen those. Look, we've all
rule
seen
one,
those.
Clap first. Well done. You're listening.
We've all seen those posters in the lobby of the airport Marriott. How to win things. Oh, what is that all about? I'm going to check it out one of these days.
Featuring appearance by the author of Waltzing with Ghosts, Christopher.
Guys, I'm not here to talk to ghosts in a European accent today. Sarah, what's so much fun about watching you perform is that since most people no one else is watching this with their eyes. They're listening to it. There is. You're playing percussion at the same time. And yeah, well, there's a few people here.
They don't count.
It's too late for that. You're playing percussion, but you have the fiddle as well.
Yeah.
And it's a crazy balancing act between like...
Well, it's not supposed to be crazy. It's supposed to be...
I mean, it is nuts.
But it's like...
It was a little crazy just now.
Because I love why... Like, you set the violin down, but you have to set it down so you can get back up and sing and then grab the sticks.
Just didn't bring the right stand. And so, yeah. And then I kept bonking the drum with my bow arm.
Can I make a suggestion?
Yes, please.
Paul, what would you do?
You need those one-man band knee cymbals.
Yep. Haven't you ever seen Arthur Nakane, the one-man band?
Who?
The elderly Asian gentleman who plays in the Santa Monica on 3rd Street Promenade.
I've seen one-man bands, of course.
Yeah.
Wait, what's his name?
Arthur Nakane, the one-man band.
The I've ghost of the of Santa him. Monica one-man band.
He's the ghost.
You know he's not alive, right?
Oh, what?
Yeah.
So you guys aren't seeing him, too?
No, he died many years ago on a night just like this.
Oh, my God. I better write this down for
do
my next book.
Do ghosts have to play ghost instruments, or do they play
ghost
real
ghost
instruments?
No, they can manipulate real instruments.
But the instruments have to die near them at the same time.
So while they're dying, someone has to smash a violin.
Yep. So they get a ghost violin.
Is there some kind of special code that only they can play, though? Because what about all the instruments that die... that died near other ghosts? Can
you can get those in Ghost Guitar Center.
I hear they're having a ghostly sale this week.
Ghostly President's Day sale.
Where the actual presidents will come in.
Fair enough.
What do you feel like, you know, what do you feel like it is that you're saying in this album specifically? What do you want people to get out of it besides just, hey, that's really nice music to listen to?
I'm sorry. They just turned on the tiniest disco ball that you've ever seen. Is it really far away? My apologies. My apologies if that is in the sky.
That is kind of odd now. The ceilings are very high. There is...
Was it all this talk of ghosts?
I think...
Someone scale a wall.
Let me take a photo.
I think what could only be described as the Billy Barty of disco balls.
Oh.
Matt, with you for scale.
Oh, yes. Oh, I throw all scale off.
That is a tiny disco ball, and now there is a...
I'm holding it.
The disco ball is spinning, and there's a colored light show happening.
I'm hypnotized.
Yeah, almost for no real reason that I can think of.
But what do you want people to think when they listen to your album?
Do you want them to think spinning disco ball?
Please. Just a little one.
What is it that, what is
I,
it?
You know, I just, I hope that it sounds, I hope that it sounds fun, and I hope that that there's a little bit of grit to it. And I hope that, you know, I hope that the lyrics are, I hope it sounds convincing, like I meant it, because I did. I had a really good time making it, and not only just a good time, like it was kind of uncomfortable at certain times because it is a little different for me, but it was also really exciting because of that. You know, I didn't want it to sound the same, so I had to do things that weren't in my normal patterns. You know what I mean? And sometimes I guess that makes it a little bit more satisfying to listen to for me, and I hope that it makes it more exciting for other people to listen to.
So, what are you in the radio game, or is there any sort of?
I don't think they let me play that game. I don't think that I'm invited at that table. Mostly, it's just I think just shows and people talking about stuff. There is a little bit. There's some AAA stations which play. More folky artists or bands that maybe used to be popular or are less top 40 sounding.
I'm sorry, what is a AAA station?
AAA station, I don't know that there is one in Los Angeles, but NPR stations would be the closest thing to a AAA station, like KCRW. They're across the country, and they just have a really broad listenership. But much smaller than mainstream. Mm-hmm. And those people, like Nickel Creek actually had an instrumental hit on AAA radio. and it was only instrumental. But like instrumentals can conceivably be played on the radio on AAA stations.
Like classical
college
gas.
Stations sometimes are AAA, like just alternative things that aren't too scary.
I love bluegrass music. I love bluegrass. I love the shit out of it. But I also see,
and you play it a little.
A little, yeah. I'm a little bit. I want to play more of it. It's just a fun genre of music. But yeah. I also feel like the term bluegrass is very, it's pretty loose now because it just bleeds. It really is. It's a standalone genre, but it also I feel like can find its way into other genres like flavors of it.
Yeah, totally. And a lot of people there are some people who are real sticklers for the bluegrass rules. And we grew up like in Southern California, bluegrass is not nearly as strict as it is in other parts of the country.
Sure.
Because it's just further away from the source, which is Kentucky, basically. Mm-hmm. But, you know, a lot of people add banjo to their band, and a listener might say, oh, they sound kind of bluegrassy because they hear a banjo or a mandolin or something. And they might. The band might sound bluegrassy, but there are other people who, you know, if you stick in two extra chords into the form or change it up a little bit, it's not included in bluegrass. Wow. It's not.
And, of course, Ape Shall Not Kill Ape is one of the one of the biggest bluegrass rules.
Yep.
Right?
I think in some parts of the country, yes. Is that right?
Yeah, is that right? Exactly right.
I'll have to check.
Yeah.
Check the book on that one.
In the more ape-populated parts of the country.
Yeah. San Francisco.
I don't want to alarm you guys.
Where apes have evolved to play.
I don't want to alarm you guys. This is actually Planet Earth. Were you?
Not this whole time.
No.
The entire time it's been Planet Earth.
What?
Yeah. Yep.
Wait, the whole time since the podcast began? Or
just forever. Like, you came to this planet thinking that it was another thing.
You sons of bitches.
But it was actually Planet Earth the entire time.
Well, there you go.
Caesar is home. Your second song on the album is a pretty remarkable song, too. Is it The One I Want or You're the One I Want?
Oh, that's the third song. You're the One I Love. It's an Everly Brothers song.
The One I Want. That's fucking Grease. You know how when you were in Grease?
That's true.
Yeah,
when you played Sandy.
Uh huh.
That song surprised me in a good way.
Good.
And I think I heard a Fiona Apple in the background.
You
of
certainly
that song.
Did. Yeah, not in the background, in the foreground. She and I are singing. At least I hope she's in the foreground.
He's got bad speakers.
Yeah, the bad. Only the left speaker.
What do you mean speakers plural?
It's a straight
I just have
up
one
duet.
Speaker.
No, we don't. Yeah, you don't. You don't need two.
What? Oh my God, I better go back and re-listen to every old Beatles.
It makes a difference.
I have this fantasy. I haven't talked to Fiona about this yet, but I have this fantasy of making a video for that song where we're both riding horses really fast, chasing each other. You haven't heard the song yet, never. Paul.
I know Fiona Apple, and that's never going to happen.
I was thinking about texting her and asking if she rides horses and...
I'm sure she does.
I mean,
start with, do you like horses? And she's going to say yes. And be like,
I can't figure it any other way. I've thought about different ways of doing this, but I think we have to actually ride our own horse.
I don't see why she wouldn't do it.
Would you settle for a mechanical horse in front of a rolling background?
No.
Okay.
I'm just checking.
Would you
make it cost effective here?
So anyway, that's my goal for that.
Is to get Fiona Apple to ride a horse with you in a video?
No, but like I'm chasing her or she's chasing me. But yes.
A horse chase.
Yeah.
You guys could chase each other because they're, you know.
We could be in a circle at equidistance and you don't know who's chasing who.
Oh.
Wait a minute.
Maybe.
I should not have gotten high before that.
Thought it would be cool, right?
I thought it would be so cool.
I mean, you didn't think there would be any weird existential horse conversations
or
happening.
Tiny disco ball.
I'm just glad I got that note in my pocket with my name and address.
Or ghost books. Or dead instruments being played.
That's right. Yeah, it's really. Boy, when you pile it up like that, I'm having a really hard time.
What other songs do you guys? I want you to be able to play a bunch of songs.
All right,
tonight.
All right. So we'll do another one then. We will do we can do Lock and Key. Mm. Want to do that one? Ooh. This is a song that I co-wrote with my friend Jenny Ann. I couldn't finish it lyrically. I was just sort of stuck on it, and she helped me via email, and then a bunch of other friends helped with the music and stuff. But this is, so anyway.
All right.
It's called Lock and Key.
There she goes. Come to the mic. Oh, please don't fall. Please don't fall.
I'm moving the drum.
That's a drum move.
All right.
Strike it.
Strike the drum.
Struck. Drumity drum move.
Struck. The most bluegrassy thing about this, our live show this year will be all the tuning that we do. It's a very, that's a big tradition in bluegrass.
There's a lot of tuning
it's
of
a
instruments.
Lot of tuning.
Is it because you're down like down tuning to different?
No, we're just trying to stay in tune.
Because you're
trying to maintain.
Plays are
hard. Huh? I don't know. It just is. I don't know.
Because when you're jamming, no, your good. Instruments come out of tune, right?
No, yeah. When you play bluegrass, you're pretty aggressively hitting the strings, and that will knock
yeah,
it out
play
of tune.
Hard. You play
yeah.
very hard.
Yeah, that's why you're tuning.
We're trying to. It's trying to make Sorry. An impact, and we don't have amps or anything, so we just have to.
I'm always like weirdly surprised when you pick up the fiddle how fucking loud it is.
It's pretty loud.
It's kind of awesome.
It's Sorry, cool. Grandma.
No, no. I said it was kind of awesome.
I know, but I
These
still wanted to say sorry,
and
Grandma.
Their goddamn fiddles.
All right.
Burn.
In the long light of early July, in the summer heat, he asked me to be his wife. He said, take my hand, and for the rest of my life, I'll be at your side. It's you and me in the by and by. He said, how long have you been a bud in bloom, with sun-kissed blush and ivory croon? So let the wind whip the green grass into dunes. My love for you runs through and through. Forever cannot come too soon. Back around, I used to lift him up, not tie him down. I'm lost, but once was found. Summer seems so far away. I'm still here, not afraid. So wind whip green grass and June. Forever's faded out of view. My ivory skin still grows. And my love for him goes through.
I clapped first that time, Paul. I clapped first that time.
You did it.
You're really the alpha male.
I submit to you.
I submit to you and your ways.
For the listener, there was a great visual burn just now when Sarah played a little tiny lick on the fiddle and then looked over at Matt and mouthed the words, too loud.
It's not. I liked how loud it was. You misunderstood. I enjoyed it.
I'm on record as being scared of violins.
Yeah, well...
I love how the bow is almost like an extension of your arm because I'm watching you maneuver it around the microphone without even looking, and without, I just feel like anyone else would be like clang, 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 clang.
That's kind of a bluegrass thing. Bluegrassers, fiddle players, as opposed to classical, people mic their instruments really high up, I think, and it's partially a tone thing and partially because they move around a lot. But bluegrassers, we're always trying to be louder, and so we kind of learn to play with the mics almost touching the instruments.
Having been on stage with you so many times, it always crosses my mind at some point, is this the time that I'm going to get stabbed in the face with the bow?
It's never happened. I stabbed Gabe.
Stabbed you yet.
No.
Gabe Witcher at Largo, at the old Largo once, got a gnarly bow. I don't, you might have been there, but it was a solid hit in the eye.
I would have remembered that.
It was, yeah, because that stage was so small.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That, and there would be like 12 people up there sometimes.
Yes.
And two fiddlers. And that takes up like half the stage right there because of the bow. And
Remember what song it was?
I don't remember. I don't remember it. I don't even remember whose night it was.
It was Tennessee Bow Eye. It was all about a guy who takes a bow in the eye.
I'd never had the guts to actually mime it out, but that night.
But that time, you're like, you know what? The audience deserves a show.
Yeah. Everyone was in the spirit.
At least I was. That's really all that matters, I guess, on that one.
Oh, you know who I would love to bring up now? I want to bring Kate McCucci over. Would you just come sit down and chat with us for a minute? Kate, come on. Kate McCucci.
Hey.
The OTAF of Garfunkel Oats. Right? Would you say you're
the
OTAF?
Oh, I am the Oats half, yes. Sarah, the records and the music is great.
Thanks, Kate.
I love it.
Thanks.
Well, I want to, because I feel like you guys are on similar paths where you're creating stuff that you love and you care about, and you're not really relying on traditional distribution models to get it out. So how's it been for you guys as well?
For us, I mean, we do it all on our own. I guess.
Yeah, Kate's much more into that than, like, she knows much more about that than I do. I still try at least to get people to get it the conventional way, but you guys just sort of made it happen on your own.
I guess for us, we don't really want to have to answer to anybody. Yeah. I don't know, but I mean, but you.
Didn't you actually, like, record a record, though, without anybody
really
knowing?
We just kind of
your managers
did it.
Didn't know.
No, we just
did
it
with, like, it was a secret.
Do you think they would have talked you out of it or something?
No, we were just gonna keep recording songs and see what happens, and we didn't really tell anybody we were doing it, and then it was like, hey, we made a record.
You what?
Yeah, which was kind of exciting. It was like our little secret project that we were doing,
just
yeah.
Like Saving Private Ryan.
Exactly.
That movie, Steven Spielberg made that movie. It was a surprise.
Hey, Steven, where you
Universal.
Been the last 18 months?
Yeah. Well, maybe you'd like to accompany me into the screening room.
Oh, okay. It's weird, but I'll allow it. I'm a judge, too.
I'm a judge, too. Just got my papers in the mail. This is kind of a big day for me.
Robe's still on its way.
That's why I'm in my bathrobe from home.
I'm just practicing. Just got to get a robe sense. Do you? So are you guys touring a lot right now?
Garfunkel and
Oates.
Yeah. We just kind of finished a crazy, you know, traveling a lot. But Ricky's actually doing a movie right now, and so we're taking a little time off, and then we'll get back to it. But yeah, Noah, I think what is the next thing we're doing? Bonnaroo.
Oh wow! Oh, that little
awesome.
Thing.
Yes.
Are you doing a lot of festivals? Sarah,
are you doing Bonnaroo? I'm doing some. I'm not doing Bonnaroo. I was trying to for a while, and then I decided to try something else instead that weekend. Bonnaroo is great. I've been there several times. Have you done it, Paul?
No.
Me neither.
Matt? That's what I'm saying. I haven't.
Is the festival circuit, I mean, it's do you like the festival circuit as a good way to, like...
Yeah, it's great. I mean, the right festivals are really fun. And the best thing about festivals is, besides if you get the right time slot and a great crowd, it can feel really, really great. But the best part is running into people that you know. And, like, I ran into you, Paul, at Sasquatch.
That's true. And that weird Outside Lands
in San Francisco.
That was quite a time.
That was a time.
What was that?
I did a set at Outside Lands that was literally under a circus tent. And I was competing with the Black Keys and I think another band whose music you could just hear just loud enough to make the whole thing completely pointless. And it was just terrible. It was
well, like, now you being a very loud comedian.
Well, you know, I love to scream and yell.
Yeah.
I smash a lot of stuff on stage.
Yep.
I always refer to Paul as the fiddle of comedians.
That's what the F stands for. Paul Fiddle Tompkins.
That's right. Yeah, it was terrible. But I don't. It's one of those weird things where it was simultaneously.
You did great, I mean.
Yeah, I did great.
Come on.
It was simultaneously. Oh, people are still talking about it. It was simultaneously great and horrible to have people I knew witness this thing. Because usually, like bad gigs like that, you're all by yourself, nobody's around, and it's like, okay, I'm the only person that knows that happened, so good.
The worst part about that setup, besides the fact that it was a tent in front of a really loud stage, was that most of the audience was up these bleachers in the back, and people who just wanted to come in and sit in the shade for like 10 minutes, they had to walk in this big tent and go up the bleachers, sit down for as long as they wanted to, as long as they
could stand it.
And then, but like it was sort of like it was set up on the grounds as like a, oh, here, come in here and check this out for 15 minutes, 20 minutes. See this comedian that you might not know. And the way that the tent was set up was just not practical for that at all. Well, so it just looked like everyone was leaving all the time.
Yeah.
It was
people like coming and going. It really was like people were there to either get on board or disembark from some mode of transportation, and there wasn't one. Like they kept going into this terminal, like, where is this? No? Okay, let's get out of here. So it was just constant, like an anthill. Moving around all the time.
It was horrible.
And it's like the problem is that with a lot of festivals like that have done music for a long time and then they add comedy, is that they think, oh, it's basically the same thing. Mm-hmm. You're on a stage and there's a sound system. But it really, you can't. It does. It's like, how is it for a musician? I talked about this with Rhett Miller a little bit, to be playing songs and seeing people come and go in situations like that, because you can kind of at least you can retreat into your own music.
Kind of, yeah. I mean, you can close your eyes and keep playing the song, and then just try not to count how many people there are after when you open your eyes.
But it's similarly disheartening to see people leaving.
I don't think it could ever feel that good. But I sympathize with the tent scenario with the comedy. Just growing up in a quiet bluegrass band, like where acoustics, you know, you're just relying on these microphones, and if you have three or four instruments, you're not that loud, and you're probably kind of playing quietly, and
so consequently, the audience is quieter because they need to be able to hear the music, the
audience is quieter. But if you're in if you're playing a stage where there's a ton of bleed, and that's the problem with a lot of these festivals, is that
the sound just
so
goes out
much
there.
Noise pollution that you can't.
You have to be standing. You have to be like right in front of the band to be hearing.
Yeah, it's hard to have an intimate experience, and it's difficult.
But now, having seen it, you have to agree. There's something extra pathetic when a dude is just talking and all of that is going on.
It's pretty bad.
It looks like in situations like that, I go outside of my body and I imagine what it looks like, and it's just this guy on stage going, hey, everybody, won't you listen to me? Won't somebody just stop for 2 seconds and just listen to what I have to say?
I really need you to hear this stuff I thought of.
Yeah.
There was a comedy, I don't know if they still have it, there was a comedy stage at Coachella like 5 years ago maybe, and I did that, and it
sounds
was
perfect.
It was like 2 o'clock in the afternoon, just like beaming hot sun.
Ugh. I'm playing the 1 o'clock set this weekend at Stagecoach. I'm really with the same setting.
Oh,
and
yeah.
It's like, it's gonna be so bad.
It's yeah, and people do just come in to cool off, so they're just kind of fanning themselves. And I think the weirdest one was Furman and I and Howard Kramer and a couple of the people played the Download Festival in Northern California. It was like the Download Festival is, you know, it's in Britain, and then they did a version of it here. And they didn't really, there was a main stage and they didn't really know where to put the comedians. So they put us like in the concession area. There was a stage And so it wasn't even like remotely a like it was just people just coming in to get drinks. And yeah. And it was kind of like what you said. But then all of a sudden you start following them with your comedy. You're like, and then here's another crazy thing happening. Okay, okay. You know, like you're just trying to you're just fucking aiming jokes like arrows and missing a lot. Just missing a lot. I was always jealous of music because of that, because I felt like at least music can sort of draw people in. You know, in a way.
Yeah. And even if it doesn't, you don't look like an asshole. Yeah, you know what I mean?
You probably play at home by yourself sometimes. None of us tell jokes to ourselves.
Seriously?
Ooh, I don't know if I can.
I'm doing it wrong.
I might actually.
What was I feel that? Like that probably happens.
I feel like Garfunkel and Oates has probably had some hellish gigs where you show up and they're like, yeah, the comedy's over there. And you're these, you know, fun.
Yeah, or we once played a small room in the House of Blues when a night of actual blues was happening, mm-hmm. but it was very loud, and you know, we have a ukulele and a tiny guitar, and but with Hard and Firm too, I'm guessing when you have music and jokes are within the song, it's a little tricky when there's other music playing. Do you find that?
Yeah, because our kind of stuff did, because you really have to pay attention to what we're saying,
right,
to make this. Otherwise, it's just, you know, a guitar and an okay played melodica, and then that's it. And that's not gonna make sense. So yeah, I mean, do you want people to be, you know, like hearing exactly what you're saying, or are you happy if they're just sort of absorbing the vibe of the music?
No, ideally they're completely enraptured in everything that's happening on stage. Ideally, there's no way that they could be distracted and that we are holding them captive. But there's certain things, like we were touring the last couple of years. You know, you play all kinds of things. You play things that turn out to be just basically parties where you're background music. And I think I should have I found myself thinking, and I still kind of think this is true, that I should have like an hour's worth of material of like Buddy Holly danceable, like Buddy Holly is danceable for me, and then my instrument says this is dance music, but like upbeat, like fun, recognizable songs for everybody. Like I should be able to entertain people of any in any environment for like an hour. That would be, I would be a real professional if I could out anything and just be like, all right, this is what
yeah,
this
but
how we deal with this.
We have those conversations about comedy too, and Paul has always been a big proponent of like, just do the stuff that you love and don't worry about trying to, you know, mm-hmm. make every, you know, like don't worry about pandering.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, I mean, making your goal like to entertain absolutely everybody is like, it's a crazy goal. It's,
right.
It's just impossible. But, you know, it's the idea that you should be able to win over any crowd no matter what. And with comedy, that's just not possible, because sometimes people are going to be too drunk, or they're going to be, or because it's such a subjective thing, they're mm-hmm. not going to be into you, and you can't do covers.
Yeah.
You know, so it's like you're just stuck with your own dumb personality.
Yeah.
And it's like it's not. It's
Here's
just
another
not
one from 1976. Yeah. The seven words that can't be said on television.
Right. Who wouldn't? Who wouldn't? We both said. but with music, yes, it's it. But would you, is that more a matter of survival, or do you really feel like it's incumbent upon you to be able to offer something for any situation?
It's both. I mean, it would make it more fun for me on stage if I could feel like I was entertaining people.
True.
And it would make it more fun for the, like that's just kind of a win-win, I feel like.
Yeah.
And but also, I mean, there is that feeling like I should, if I'm a professional, I should be able to handle this scenario rather than play more, you know, medium tempo songs.
Boy, sometimes though all you can do is just at a certain point like you say, you just kind of shut your eyes and get through it.
Yeah.
And then know, like, well, yeah, you know, I did everything. I find I'm only really, I only feel like I failed in a show. It has some to do with the audience, but also how did I handle it?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And
totally.
Did I fold like a novice performer, or did I just go, well, they just weren't into this and that's fine, and I can still have a fun show,
mm-hmm.
and I don't have to have applause breaks and people can still have an okay time. You know, like how do you rate a successful show?
Yeah, it's similar. Like if you don't let it affect you too much and you can actually have a little bit of, feel a little bit of dignity with how you handled it at the end of the show.
It's not asking so much, right? Just a little bit of dignity.
Just a little ounce.
That makes me wonder, because for a comedian, what we do, like the how well I perform
is so tied up with how the audience responds. Mm-hmm. That's how I know that I did a good job. I mean, you can walk away from a bad show and say, I tried my best, but I didn't win these people over. But there could still be a night for a musician where maybe if the crowd is not that into it, can you still feel like I was really good tonight? Yep. Right?
Yeah. There's still a little bit of satisfaction being like, okay, we finally hit that part right. We finally...
The difference for comedians, though, is that you walk away from it saying, I'm still good in theory.
No, but don't
like,
you...
the idea of me doing comedy is still sound.
When you're forming... when you're forming a joke, though, or a plot or a story, whatever, like, and you feel like you're still figuring it out and you're still finding the points that you want to hit, do you ever feel like I finally timed it right? And they just didn't get it. I mean, obviously you can always blame the audience, but like, do you ever, you can feel like that, right? Like that you made progress in a certain way.
Not with a bad show. I've felt it where I know that exact feeling of, oh, it all fell into place tonight. This thing that I've been working on for a while, it finally all came out the way that I wanted it to come out, the perfect phrasing and you know all that. Yeah. But I don't know that I've ever had that happen at a show where people were not into what I was saying.
Interesting.
You know, because that feeds you.
It helps you.
Yeah. Because you have the confidence of, okay, they're with me.
Gives you the confidence you need to succeed.
Hey, that rhymes, Marge, and you know it rhymes.
I feel like that's a deodorant line or
There's
something.
This video, this DVD.
I feel like that's what it is. I stole it.
I think you're right.
Like Degree or something.
They should have
it. It might be Degree.
I think it might be.
Antiperspirant.
What's your video?
No, there's a DVD of Stevie Ray Vaughan playing at this jazz festival in Sweden, and they're just expecting jazz, and he starts playing fucking... crazy Stevie Ray Vaughan blues, and they're booing him.
Like, oh my god,
booing him, and he just goes at it. And by the end of the show, half the audience is gone, but the people who are there are standing up, like, and just enthralled with Stevie Ray Vaughan. And that's the kind of thing I don't think you can beat people over the head with comedy, unless you're Bill Burr.
You can, yeah. Bill can do that. But how do you guys feel about it?
Well, I mean, with the song, it's kind of the same, like. You know, if it's not going well, we're not going to stop the song halfway through.
Yeah.
You know, we got to keep going no matter what. And so, I mean, there's almost even some sort of safety in that. Like, well, we played the song rather than, you know, like...
At least, you know, time will be killed.
Yeah. Well, I mean,
this will advance us another 3 minutes into the future, and then eventually we'll be done.
Do you ever choose the long songs?
Yeah.
Yeah, let's just get out of here. But listen, like three songs would get... Yeah, I don't know. I mean, but with jokes, I mean, you can make hard left and right turns
with stand up, but having the experience with Hard and Firm, it's like their songs are basically sketches, and you have to, unless it's I don't think we've ever just stopped and been like, all right, let's all just agree that this didn't go well and we'll leave. But
I've,
you know,
totally done that.
Have you really?
Yeah, we've done that.
Really? What happened?
Not lately, but yeah, in Nickel Creek we would do it a couple times where it was just some song that we would have a really hard time with. I think we did it with like Evelyn or something, or some song that was really challenging, or we couldn't figure it out, and we went for it, and then, or like the tuning was just so bad and something else was wrong, we're just like, never mind, we're just not gonna do this.
It's that moment in your brain where
everyone's gonna be a lot better off.
You're
if
like,
we just
maybe I can
here.
Save it, maybe I can save it, and then it just tips and you're like, it's gone.
Yeah.
I've lost it.
And when there's three of you on, like Kate, you can probably like, you're always kind of negotiating, like, are we going for this or are we not?
Yeah.
You're kind of looking at each other like, if you stop, I'm not gonna scream.
We were nervous because Ricky and I opened for you guys, when was it, a couple months ago for the Watkins Family Hour, was it?
Yeah.
And we didn't know how your audience would handle our material.
That's always a question.
So I was kind of like, oh gosh, I hope. But, you know, it was one of those, like, we walked away, well, they didn't, I think they were listening, you know, like.
They loved
like,
you. They
totally loved you.
It's hard because, you know, it's a different crowd and not everybody appreciates, you know.
Well, the Watkins Family Hour is pretty clean.
Yeah.
And it started out that way, and now we just kind of feel like we should just continue.
Well, it was so nice
and
of you
so
to
our audience is not expecting
dick jokes.
Hand jobs.
Yeah. We didn't do the hand job rap. We tried to be as clean as possible.
It's possible.
So there were a couple swear words, but nothing crazy. But yeah.
It was great.
Yeah, that was fun. But I think with us too, like we are pretty loose, like you know, a pick gets dropped and, you know, 10 seconds will go by and we'll talk and then we'll pick up where we left off, you know, things like that.
Well, and with comedy though, you also have the safety net of, because Furman and I had like 60% of our shows, something went wrong. technologically, where literally, like, something would happen, a guitar would go out, a mic would go out, you know, we would play along with a video screen. I accidentally kicked the plug out of the projector once, and we just had to start over, which meant we had to go back to the beginning of the disc. And just, like, fast forward through, like, well, you guys are familiar with this part already. And but we have the safety net of being able to like, just play it off as, well, it's a comedy and we're fucking around.
Yeah.
Do you use that at all, or are you kind of, or?
Well, it depends on the setting. Like, sometimes if it seems like the kind of show where, or the kind of venue where people are, kind of, they don't really care. They're just there to have a good time and they trust you and they're along for the ride. Then you can do anything like that.
But you know what? Go ahead.
I was just gonna, like, sometimes you play art centers where everyone's just sitting on their hands all night and they just kind of want to sit there and be entertained. And
I hate art people. I think the big difference, is that, because I've seen musicians do that where they will, you know, it's like an old song of theirs that they don't remember the words to anymore.
Yeah.
And they like start and they're like, I can't remember. And they stop and everybody's like, that's the greatest.
But he doesn't remember the thing he wrote.
Yeah. Because the audience by and large is saying, well, I can't do what that person can do. So anything that this person does, anything this person says goes. But if you're watching comedy, everybody thinks they're funny. Everybody, there's a good percentage of the crowd that might be thinking, I'm funnier than this dude.
People are the worst.
I should get up there.
Don't say that.
I wonder.
I'm sorry to all those people out there.
People listen to this.
I'm sorry.
Because obviously, you know, there's a certain amount of charisma and personality when you see a band live. It's not just about being technically proficient.
Yeah.
So what, you know, obviously you started at a young age, so you were used to performing for people, but do you, you know, how do you feel you've grown as a performer, and how, you know, how open are you on stage just as a personality?
It depends on the night. Sometimes I don't feel like having any kind of personality and we'll just play a lot of songs back to back to back as much as possible until there's some kind of stride that's hit. And sometimes it's just really open the whole night and there'll be a dialogue with the audience and it depends. It's fun to play a variety of different of venues where the audience brings something different every night, where they're coming to see us right now if we're playing our own show. So that's nice. Like, that's enough of a guarantee that they'll be paying a little bit of attention. And then from there you're thinking like, okay, so are they here because this is just what they do on once a month? Or are they here because they want to drink, and or are they here because they just want to have a good time and they know my material? And that really dictates the feel of the show more than anything.
Do you play a lot of venues where people are sitting down, or do you play venues where people are standing
up? Yeah, a lot of sit-down venues. My favorites are the one where they'll be standing on the bottom and maybe a balcony up top where people can sit down, because, you know, not everyone likes to stand all night. But it's fun to have the energy of people right up close and to see them being excited rather than a big empty, you know, 6 to 15 feet before the chairs start. And it's just like a vacuum for energy. It sucks. But, what was I going to say? I was going to say something. I'll say it later.
Okay.
I did a show once, at a record store. And it was like in the back room of a record store, or no, it was not the back room of a record store.
Oh,
it was a show for four people.
Everyone sat on the record stacks.
That's right. They just did a show in this record store and there was no real stage. There was a mic and there were no chairs or anything. So people were, we were all at the same level.
Oh, yes.
It was the weirdest. I'd never experienced this before, where I'm just standing there. And it was like I felt like either I was rallying these
people.
To go, we're going to go kill a monster, or these people are going to murder me. Like, any moment now, they're just going to rush at me and tear me
like
limb from limb.
You're just barely holding them off.
Yeah, like, hold on a second. Hold on. You don't understand. I didn't steal that. I just found it.
Yeah, well, why are you holding that microphone?
Gosh, I can't imagine doing comedy without a microphone. That's just a total...
No, there was a microphone.
You had a mic. Okay.
Yeah, and that was the only thing
that prevented
me from running away. He was like, oh, this makes it a show and not just a weird mob that I'm addressing.
Mm.
Do you have another, can you play something else?
Yes.
What do you want to play?
Well, I want to I know what song I want to end with.
Okay.
Should I do that one now, or should I do one first?
Do another one first.
Okay. Let's do the. We'll do a fiddle. We'll do a fiddle tune. This is the first song on the record.
Okay.
Yeah, it's called The Foothills. Right?
We'll take your word for it, Chris. We couldn't hear the looping.
Well, I have headphones on, Matt. Please don't trip and fall. Every time you run over there in those shoes, I'm like, she's gonna spill.
It's not the shoes. It's sometimes it just happens no matter what with me, no matter what shoes I'm wearing.
Are you a klutzy gal?
I'm a little, yeah. Yeah, I fall sometimes.
But then you pick yourself right back up.
I try.
And isn't that what life?
Both your eardrums are punctured, right? So it affects your balance.
That's right. That's right, Paul.
Because Gabe had it. Gabe got his revenge.
A Boeing accident. You actually, because you can go. I don't know if you guys ever saw the Three Stooges. You can go in one ear
with
a bow.
Yeah.
And then come directly out the other ear.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
So thereby damaging both eardrums
too, yeah.
Simultaneously, or arrow, mm-hmm. or the arrow through the head.
Movie.
Or the arrow through the head.
Just thanks the Three Stooges.
Three Stooges movie. Yeah.
Is that a character?
Spoilers.
Spoiler, they're bad plumbers.
How? They are. I don't know why they keep getting work. They, how are you pretty, are you hard on yourself? Are you pretty hard on yourself?
I don't think so.
Oh, good. Well, you just said you were anxious, like you had some anxiety, and so I just thought.
Well, no, I don't think I'm hard on myself. Sometimes.
Should you be?
Probably. I could be a lot harder on myself. You're right. I'm not hard enough on myself. Jeez. No, I mean, it's sometimes, I just, the more things that I do, the less anxious I get. Like the more that I realize, oh yeah, I can do this and I don't die and it's fine. Then yeah. I get less anxious.
Cause you seemed, you know, when we had lunch and you were like, yeah, I turned 30. Like we sort of, what we talked about earlier, you really kind of embraced, it was almost like you felt.
I loved it. I loved turning 30. It was awesome. Like, what? Great, I don't have to, I don't know, it's just all this stuff from my 20s, I don't have to worry about it anymore. I feel like, this is bygones.
Are you okay with getting older?
Yeah, so far, so good.
Oh, I'm going to hate it.
I mean, I'm sure I'm not going to like it,
people,
you know, when
people
I can't
who,
walk and everything,
yeah,
but.
People who look young always are fine with getting older.
No, yeah. It's not, I think I'm okay with, you know, I'm probably not going to like it when I look in the mirror and feel like I see a, you know, like a turtle or something, but I feel like.
Well, that's probably a sign that you've had a stroke.
Yeah, maybe.
Maybe that's, I don't know if that's.
Is that one of the signs of a stroke?
If you smell mirror, toast, you see a turtle.
Quick, look in the mirror. What do you see there?
It's a turtle. Oh my God, Cole.
Go take an aspirin right now.
Already. It's too late.
It's a giraffe. You're fine.
No, guys, it's okay. It's okay. I put a terrarium in the bathroom.
Why would you do that?
It's not a stroke turtle.
In the end, the stroke turtle comes for us all.
I think that was a Kansas song, right?
That's right.
Yeah, that was a song
played over
Kansas.
The credits of No Country for Old Men.
Big themes. Big themes.
I always
how do you feel about getting old?
I don't love it. I mean, I don't think any. I mean, I just, you know, it is
the most honest you've ever been on this podcast.
That's not true.
You hate it.
Way to interrupt the moment, then.
I don't. Listen, it feels weird, you know, like it does feel weird because you have these ideas in your head about, you know, what it means to be, you know, 30, 40, 50 years old. We look at our parents and the generation before that. Everyone just looked old.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then you kind of look at yourself in the mirror and you go, well, I'm that age where everyone looked old to me when I'm younger, but I don't see it. So I must just, maybe they don't see it either. Like, maybe that's just part of it.
I think part of it is, for me, it's just, like, I've got a bunch of great friends, and I've got a great... somebody here watching feels like they're a friend of mine, apparently. And, like, I've got a great family, and I feel like I just don't have to... I don't feel obligated to question everything that I think anymore. So while I don't feel like I'm the most opinionated person in the world... I'm just a little bit more comfortable with my thought process as my thought process, and just feeling like, oh, I'm a person, and here I go.
And when you're making...
it's just a lot more simple than it used to be.
And when you made this album, were you saying, like, well, I really should probably do more of this kind of thing because I want it to appeal to this, or did you just literally say, I'm going to do...
This was it. Yeah, I didn't want to make it with anybody besides Blake Mills. I knew that, like, this is the right guy. I didn't have anybody else in mind, and then I met him and I was like, this makes sense, let's do this. And he was into it, and he had the schedule, and so we just did it, and it was a pretty easy process by and large, and it was fast too, which was really nice. We made the whole thing in 3 or 4 weeks, and
oh wow,
and just knocked it out. And that was just in January, so the whole process, it comes out May 8th, and that's a pretty quick turnaround for records anyway. So, and it's nice to keep the momentum going.
Can you, when you're recording, do you have a producer's brain, or do you just kind of stand back, be the artist, and let him sort of...
It depends on the producer. This time there was a lot of he was definitely a hands-on producer, and he played a lot of the instruments on the record, and so a lot of it was me sitting back while he finished his idea and then weighing in my opinions, but letting him...
What a showboat.
Letting... So you produced his record.
No, I mean, like, like, that's basically no, but that's just trying to figure out the balance of, like, how to let the people that you're working with do their thing and not interfere with it too much, because obviously we wanted to work together. I wanted to work with him, and so there's a little bit, the first couple of weeks, of figuring out how to not dance around each other too much, how to be honest and just get down to work. And we fell into a rhythm pretty quickly. And he works really fast. And the engineer, Sean Everett, is amazing. And they're a great team together.
It's hard not to micromanage sometimes, though, especially...
Yeah.
I mean, because ultimately, it's your face on the album, and it's your voice, and
Absolutely.
It's your name. And so, you know, how do you know when... If he's kind of pushing you in one direction, and just in your gut, you're like, oh, I don't know. At what point do you just trust him and go, all right, fuck it, I guess he knows what he's talking
about. Sometimes I would say I'm really uncomfortable with this. But again, like, I wanted to collaborate. I didn't want everything to be comfortable with my brain, or else I would have just made the record by myself, you know. And so a lot of it is letting things develop until I decide, like, okay, no, this is actually really great, and I never would have come up with it, and I'm really glad it's there. And other times I would feel like that I don't identify with this at all, it's nothing that I care about, let's go back to square one, and we would do that.
You must have that. I mean, you are a duo, so you sort of have a 50-50 thing going.
Yeah, I think it's always surprising, though, how on the same page we are. We'll be like, usually make it sound more 80s, where's the Richard Marx piano, things like that.
Things of that nature.
but I mean, you know, there'll be times where we have to, you know, figure it out, but Mike Furman produced a lot of our record.
Yeah.
And so, you know, there were three of us, so usually we'd figure it out between the three of us if there was a question. But it was we pretty much kind of had an idea of what we wanted to do. Yeah,
well, yeah, it just, you know, it's because people sort of, you know, people, there's frequencies and people are sort of like sine waves, and a lot of sometimes you're in phase and other times you're not. And I, you know, I'm always interested to find out how, at what, because, you know, there's a lot of stuff that when, you know, when we're making stuff, whatever it is, I don't know everything. So it's, you know, so there's a little bit of leap of faith, like, well, yeah, that guy probably knows what he's talking about, but
yeah. But I mean, like the nice thing about recording is you can go with an, you can indulge somebody, and then if, you know, you live with that for a couple of days and you still don't like it, then you can revisit it. It's, it, you're never in danger. It, like the way we made the record, we were overdubbing a lot of things. So we weren't in danger of guessing wrong and then being stuck with it, which is the worst. That is, that's like my ultimate fear of just like, all right, let's just try this and go with it. And then you have to tour behind it for 3 years and you end up not identifying with it after the moment of recording it. And that just sounds like such a rotten way to spend your time.
Oh, what if you, could you ever, I mean, this is sort of like a luxury problem. If you had just an accidental hit song that you hate, that you didn't really like, but you're like, ah, fuck it. And then all of a sudden it becomes a hit song. How do you deal? How, like, what's the, what do you, how do you deal with it?
It's, you know, it's a nice problem to have.
You cry into your money, Chris.
Ultimately, well, it's your fault for recording it.
You can cry into your money for a little while, but for the rest of your career, people are always going to want you to play that song. And then the money doesn't make it better forever.
Unless you're Bobby McFerrin.
Yeah.
Well, the whole, that whole song, though, is really advice in itself.
Ooh, that's true. Good, so advice. Sometimes he could listen to it while he's singing.
Yeah. I hate this song. Wait a minute. Listen to his own.
Then he had that hit fifth season of Cosby Show theme.
But I would imagine it's, even if there's a song that you do like, that there could be, there could be a time where you're like, man, I would love to never play this song again, but I have to because people expect me to play it.
Well, that's what, that's that, what happens when famous musicians play, but then people are like, you didn't play any of the hits, and they were like, because I just couldn't stand to hear myself. Yeah.
But I'm, I would imagine that the longer your career goes, the more of a journey you go on with that material, because you're just building more and more, you're adding more and more to your canon, and it's got to be, you have there's peaks and valleys with any piece of music that I'm sure there might be times for you that there might be a song that you know you've played for years that you might feel like I gotta step away from that one for a while. I just can't.
And ideally you have something you can sub in or something. But like John Hartford, who's a really, he's a legendary folk and bluegrass musician. He used to say, like, play one for them. What was it? Like two for them, one for me. Mm-hmm. And
seems fair.
Right, you know?
It's a short concert. And
oh, three songs, Hartman. Never played more than three songs.
But I mean, like,
should always be sure that one was for him, though.
Yeah. Never did care for that last song.
Wasn't for you, Matt.
This last song's entitled "I Got Your Money."
Ultimately, you don't have to play the songs you don't want to if you want to make people mad.
Yeah.
You just have to decide whether you'd rather make people mad and you satisfy yourself.
You're never going to please everybody because it's like, you know, there's always, I would see, you know, message boards of bands that I liked where people talk about a concert that I had just seen. And then people saying, he didn't play this song or she didn't play that song. And there's always, and this is a concert that was like 2 hours long where so much material was covered from every phase of this person's career. And it's still not enough because they didn't hear the one song they wanted to hear. And in a very proprietary way, like, this is absurd to me that this song was not played, and why did I even bother going to that show, you know? So you it's back to that same thing of like, you're not going to get everybody at the same time.
And that's one nice thing about not being a person who is expected to be successful on the radio. Like, generally people listen to a selection of songs on the record, and there might be one that stands out to most people. But you don't feel like you're risking your career if you just don't play it one night, you know?
Yeah.
Because by and large, they're probably listening to more than one song. And when you get played on the radio a lot, there was a time when Nickel Creek, we had a couple songs played on country music television, CMT, and there was this one song, When You Come Back Down, that people would come, and country music fans were coming for a while, and they were very particular about wanting to hear that song when they wanted to hear it, and they were very vocal about it. And we started to realize that wasn't really for us, and kind of stopped eventually kind of peeled away from that market and
wow.
and tried to we realized we could move because our other fans who weren't country fans were getting mad. So there were like the cowboy hat people who were getting yelled at by our quiet fans who would be just shushing them and getting mad at them, and they were kind of so almost fights breaking out.
I want
out.
One, I wow. want, and I want it now.
Well, I mean, like, it's a radio
the
audience
cowboy hat
thing.
Guy would
it's
say.
A radio thing.
Yeah.
So they're just calling out for the song over and over and over again.
That's all they want to hear, yeah.
This gets to another thing, is that I can't stand it and ruin seeing live music for me. The constant calling out of songs. I would see Mike Doty at the El Rey, mm-hmm. and I had never seen him live before. And people, as soon as the song is over, people are screaming requests mm-hmm. at this guy. And it was insane after every single song. And it's like, what? I don't understand what? Because
you're not performing and people aren't like, elegant balloon.
Well, but clearly it was not like, he wasn't up there going, I don't know, guys, what do you think? What should happen now? You know, like, he clearly, like, obviously there's a set list and he's going to play the songs that he's going to play. Maybe he'll take a request, but, like, just the idea that the entire audience is going to scream suggestions
at him. Because I think there's a certain element of when people go to a live show, they have no control over how the performance is when they're just listening to their MP3 player or whatever. But when they go to a show, there's a little bit of element of, I'm going to be a puppeteer. Like, they want to control the experience a little bit.
But don't they have more control when they're listening on an MP3 player? They can hear whatever song they want to hear.
But they,
and now they're having a
really
different experience. It's happening
this.
In real life.
No, Paul, you're
like, I went to see Elvis Costello, and somebody yelled out, Allison. Do you really think he's not going to get to it? And even if he doesn't, great. He's got a million songs. Like, the first hit, like, I don't know. So he kind of peaked at Allison, and then it was downhill after that. No, it was at the Kodak.
That's pretty ridiculous.
But I bet it happened at the Will Turn,
yeah,
too.
It did.
You know what I mean?
Ricky and I were playing a show once, and this started to happen. I think we were deciding between two songs, and people started screaming. And then one guy, louder than everybody, just went, play your set list!
And
it was
wow!
kind of the best heckle ever, and then we just did.
That's amazing.
Yeah,
that's amazing.
Like, I choose that request.
Yeah.
Kate, that person was me.
Thanks, Paul. Thank
you
so much.
Paul's trying to even the score.
I'm going to every concert, no matter what it is.
He's really trying to make up for clapping early.
That's right. It's my punishment. Like Marley's ghost, I have to walk the earth yelling, play your set list.
Are you going to tour soon?
Yes. I'm going on tour with Dawes, opening for Dawes in June, and then opening for Jackson Browne in July, half July through.
He played on the album as well, right?
Yeah, he sang, yeah.
Wow. There was the...
We put him in a gang vocal. You can hear him poking out.
You just brought him up a little bit.
Yeah.
Well, there was one after we did a show together at Largo. It was the Ed Helms Bluegrass situation,
mm-hmm.
right? And then afterwards, the after show was in the little room at Largo,
mm-hmm.
and it was you and Sean, and then Ed playing banjo, and then friggin' Jackson Browne just jumps up on stage.
Yeah.
It was
good like that.
Mind-blowing.
He's pretty great. His the tone of his voice is just so rich, and it's just better than ever, I feel like. And for the record, I should say, going back to the last point, I would be honored if anybody shouted out any requests at my shows. Because I'm at the point where I'm like, you know a song!
Right.
Play that Nickel Creek song!
Yeah,
Little Cowpoke!
Cowpoke.
How come y'all don't look like kids anymore?
I can just understand.
Just requesting.
Look like kids!
Look like kids.
Put them braids in your hair.
Look like kids.
Come on. I paid my money, and this motherfucker doesn't have the decency to be 16 no more. What the shit?
Well, we're about at the end of the podcast. The album is called Sun, Midnight Sun. It comes out May 8th. And you're going to be touring. Are you touring all over? Where are you going?
Yeah, well, yeah, most
just
of the
all
states.
Of those places. Okay.
Yeah, over the states. There's hopefully in the West Coast in the fall, but we'll be mostly in the Midwest and East Coast.
SarahWatkins.com. No H.
Hmm.
SarahWatkins. At SarahWatkins on Twitter.
Nice one.
Thank you.
Still no H.
Still no H. You didn't want to pick up an H for Twitter?
Yeah.
All right.
It was probably taken.
It's like a free character. How could you know?
Not even Watkins? W-H-A-T?
That would have been better.
That just confused people.
Watkins.
But you offered to play a very special song at the end of the podcast.
Yes, we did.
Which I am super, super, super excited about. I've never seen anyone cover this song live.
We will do our best with our three instruments. This song was a little bit more challenging to learn than we had imagined when we first signed on for this. And it was really fun to figure it out, actually. We have played it together a couple of times, but mostly just separately. So here we will go now.
It's by Screwdriver.
Okay.
Sarah Watkins, thank you so much for being here, Sarah Watkins. Please, huge hand from our tiny audience tonight. Sarah Watkins, Sean Watkins, Taylor, what was Taylor's last name?
Tyler Chester.
Well, I'm going to go with Taylor. I'm going to go with Tyler Taylor, if that's all right with you.
Soldier Chester.
Tyler Chester.
Gotta be quick.
Gotta do it. Thank you so much for being here. I'm super excited
Thanks
about your album.
Us.
And I am always pleased to see you doing well and making fun things. I'm a huge fan. So let me just slobber all over your ego, if that's all right, for a second.
Perfectly
and
fine.
Thank you so much for coming on. Enjoy your burrito, everyone.
Now no one say anything.
Thank you.
What?
I don't...
Was that for...
That's how we
are we getting burritos?
I say thank you.
Yeah, we're getting fucking crazy burritos. Sweet.
Yeah. All right, cool. I don't know how to stop this now.
Well, thanks, Jonah.
Jonah didn't say a word this entire podcast.
Very well behaved.
The part of Jonah was played by Kate McCucci.
My head, it was Paul.
Thank you too, Kate McCucci.
Oh, yeah.
Shout from the back.
Now leaving Nerdist.com. Enjoy your burrito.
Gen Z high school girls have gone through a lot. So what could and did send a shockwave through a group of 50 of them competing in one of the nation's biggest scholarship competitions? I'm your host, Shimo Liai, and I'm going to take you behind the scenes of the Distinguished Young Women Competition. I was Nevada's competitor 20 years ago, but this time, a Supreme Court decision catapults all 50 girls into the center of a nationwide debate about their rights. These girls, who have spent months fighting to make it to nationals, are faced with a tough decision. Do they speak up for their political beliefs, or do they stay focused on winning the money?
I think it's going to get ugly.
Follow the competition on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can binge all episodes of the competition early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus.